Bienvenidos, that's California for welcome to the May 25th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist and an author. He's the host of the Capital Record podcast, which if you haven't heard it, you must. And the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. And there's something else I am.
Tell me.
I'm your friend.
You are indeed. I'll put that in. I think everybody knows that by now. So let's get to some letters, if you don't mind. We get lots of them. I have filtered down. I hope nobody minds. But there's a really interesting one from listener Brett Gerard, who said, listening to episode 221 from a couple of weeks ago, forgive me, I'm a bit behind, and wanted to contribute to the Salton Sea lithium topic. Frequent listeners will remember that the Salton Sea in Southern California is apparently one of the largest deposits of lithium, not just in the United States, but maybe in the Western Hemisphere. Huge, huge deposits. And these, of course, lithium, these deposits are critical to battery manufacture. Everybody knows about lithium batteries. So when we hear on this show anybody like Gavin Newsom talk about clean energy, we want to remind people that there's always a trade-off. Hence the letter from Brett. That was my footnote, by the way. My family has a fair bit of land, Brett writes, right at the sea's south edge, and we're there almost every weekend during the winter. This is to say that I have some familiarity with the area, and I find it amusing our most blessed and gifted governor would choose the Imperial Valley as his milk crate atop which he can trumpet his green agenda. The Salton Sea plays home to the Sunny Bono National Wildlife Refuge, which touts itself as hosting some of the most abundant variations in, quote, feathered theropod dinosaurs. I think that's a fancy word for birds. I can only imagine, Brett writes, what a vast lithium mining operation would do to the habitat of the most diverse conglomeration of living dinosaurs. Is there no consideration for our winged friends, or are we okay with them flitting away in the name of green, like so many of the streamers, quote unquote, that have fallen prey to the clean energy of solar arrays, or the eagles clobbered by windmill blades, or the many that have perished due to the lake effect of solar panel farms? I'm no environmentalist, but find it humorous that the idea of trade-offs is rarely, if ever, factored into the agendas of these progressive hacks. As a brilliant, young, handsome investment manager once wrote, there is no free lunch. I think he's talking about you, David.
Well, when he said handsome and author and the other things, that's what I thought too. But then he said young.
You are young compared to your host, or your co-host,
this is
true. Right? Yeah. We got somebody who requested anonymity. Listeners will remember that a couple of weeks ago when the Supreme Court decision in Roe, a draft document was leaked, and Mia Bonta, who is an assemblywoman from Oakland, a Democrat, and the wife of Rob Bonta, the attorney general appointed by Gavin Newsom, she mentioned at a press conference not just that she'd had an abortion, but that her husband was there when she had it, and he held her hand through the whole ordeal.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful story.
It was touching. This anonymous listener writes, regarding the story and the notion of hand-holding, it implies that emotional support is necessary and appreciated. But why? If you're choosing to simply lance a boil and not end a human life, why should it be emotional at all? Another anonymous listener said he's listened for a long time. He or she, sorry, don't actually know anymore.
I wonder if there are some now that would say, I needed the emotional support, not because it is difficult and painful. It is just like lancing a boil. It's a very basic medical procedure, and that part's all the easy part. But I needed my husband to support me because of the emotional persecution that the pro-lifers put me through. No, I mean, I wonder if there's someone to say that. Like, they've caused this guilt, and then, like, they might even be, I don't know, do they still protest on the sidewalks? I don't think that really happens anymore.
Conscience is pricked, if you'll pardon the pun. A listener writes in and says, found the interview with Lance Christensen, which we did a few weeks ago, the candidate for superintendent of public instruction, fascinating. It would seem creating an effective check on political supermajorities might start with lower visibility offices, first point. But does this guy, or the guy you've had on before who is running for state auditor, Lonnie Chen, have any realistic chance of winning? P.S., the listener writes, Are you any relation, that is me, to the excellent Barton Swaim, who writes for the Wall Street Journal? So let's take these in order. Creating an effective check on political supermajorities might start with lower visibility offices. That's exactly what a number of people are doing, especially, I would argue, California Policy Center. Our CLEO project, that stands for California Local Elected Officials, trains people in public office. David has just prepared, you remember this, you sat with Will O'Neill a week or two ago and did one of the sections for us. We have a training series coming out with Pepperdine University for local governance. It's called the Leadership Academy. Right now, that's the working title. But it's for anybody of any political persuasion who wants to know what the real guardrails are here. How do you understand the job of local governance in a state like California? What should you be focused on? And of course, we offer a lot of very free market, liberal, classical liberal alternatives there to the way California is governed. So yes, lower ranking offices are super important. And that's related to something that we talked about a week or two ago, I think it was just last week's episode with John Fleischman, that the Republican Party in California has become not so effective statewide as it is regionally in California. There are very, very strong conservative places in California, the Central Valley, of course, a lot of the more rural areas, almost anything outside of LA, San Diego, and San Francisco is sort of fair game. Orange County is still reliably conservative for the most part, but even there, as we will talk about later, you have problems among conservatives. And my friends who do what I do, David, in other states, you know, in the Deep South, for instance, or the Midwest, say, look, we have a similar problem in our states. That is, people who are nominally Republican, but are, you know, one guy was telling me in his state, I think it was Tennessee, because I was in a big group of these guys, that they've got literal socialists who are registered Republicans who run as an R. So we all have this problem of how do you break through the logjam of not just supermajorities of Democrats, but of people who are just not thinking about principle. And yes, I am related distantly to Barton Swaim. Both of us can track. Barton writes for the Wall Street Journal. You may have seen his name around.
I do.
And he and I exchange emails when one of us is confused with the other. I've gotten congratulations on stories he's written, which is always to my benefit. Similarly for him. And we've traced, I think I've mentioned this before, this common link back in North Carolina, the crusading patriot, fighting patriot. He was called William Swaim, editor of the Greensboro Patriot, abolitionist newspaper in North Carolina. So Barton and I are related that way. All right, David, lots of stories here. And I want to start with one quick historical note. This is going to give you a chance to get your stories up or just think about whatever it is you're doing multitasking some of the time. I wanted to talk about 156 years ago this week.
What were you doing that day?
I was co-hosting Radio Free California with a much younger co-host.
Yes.
On May 24th, 1866, I'm reading from the Berkeley Historical Society webpage. This is not my own language here. On May 24th, 1866, some of the trustees of the private College of California met on their future campus site at a place later called the Founders Rock. They've been trying for months to find an appropriate name for their property, which at that time was kind of linked to Oakland. So they stand out on this rocky outcropping looking towards San Francisco Bay and the Golden Gate, and one of the trustees suddenly recalls a poem. And this is so 19th century that somebody standing on a rocky outcropping in a roughly wilderness kind of area would recall a poem in its entirety and then recount it for everybody. It's by the bishop and poet and philosopher George Berkeley, born 1685, died 1753. And I didn't know this, but Berkeley is named after Bishop George Berkeley. And his poem was what inspired these guys to name their little College of California Berkeley, and the area on which that college stands. And this poem, which is absolutely amazing, it's from Verses on the Prospect of Planting Arts and Learning in America. So Berkeley's this guy out of Ireland, right? He's in the United Kingdom, but he writes this poem about how the future is really in the west of England, that is, west of Europe. A couple of, you know, it starts out, the muse disgusted at an age and clime barren of every glorious theme, and distant land now waits a better time, producing subjects worthy fame. It goes on, but there's this famous line toward the end of this very brief poem, and I'll put this in the show notes. Westward the course of empire takes its way. The first four acts already passed. A fifth shall close the drama with the day. Time's noblest offspring is the last. And here we are in America, on the West Coast, near Berkeley. Well, you know, reasonably close to Berkeley, named for the British philosopher George Berkeley and his famous line, which you can find probably, many of our listeners, I'm sure, have heard that phrase, "Westward the course of empire takes its way." So hear, hear to Berkeley, its founding, and the now largely hidden source of that name, philosopher.
Well done.
Thank you, buddy. Okay, so let's head to the stories this week. Elon Musk says there's three things that are ruining California. A couple of days ago, he makes a big speech at a conference in Miami, and he tells people, look, man, California used to be the land. He doesn't say, look, man, that's me. He says, California used to be the land of opportunity. However, it's turned into the land of taxes, overregulation, and litigation. And this, he says, in typical understatement, is not a good situation. Musk, of course, has left and moved to Texas, building in Austin a gigafactory three times the size of the Pentagon, completed in just 18 months in Austin. Can you imagine anything being completed in 18 months here?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he says here, if you had a gun to Gavin Newsom's head and said, we need to start building this factory right now, he just couldn't do it. There are so many regulatory agencies and so many litigators in California.
But what are the three things?
I think it's just that. I read the story a couple of times, and I think it's just this. It's turned into the land of taxes, overregulation, and litigation. I think those are the three things. I think that's all. It was kind of in passing, but I just thought I would mention it because Elon's still in the news regarding, you know, California and Twitter. And he says what we all know.
You know what's interesting about that is I bet a lot of business proprietors, not the wealthiest people in the world necessarily, and not Fortune 100 companies that have also defected from California, but I bet just a kind of typical business and economic critique of the state would focus, perhaps even in that order, on where is it here? On taxation, regulation, and litigation. You know, there's first of all kind of a rhyme situation there that's good, and consistency. Those are three distinct categories, but are all impediments to successful business enterprise. So I would agree. But what I think is interesting is I'm not sure that's what the most common response would be in a broader context. When you look at families that have gone to Franklin, Tennessee, or to Texas, and you look around at this incredible migration out of the state, I understand a business taking its company elsewhere is going to focus there. But I think schools, crime, water, cultural, just kind of insanity of the culture war, I think those things would be higher on the list. So in a lot of ways, I agree with Elon's list, and I think it is indicative of that category's critique. But I don't think it's the same three reasons that if you were to go, let's say we found 50,000 people who make between 75 grand and 300 grand a year that have left as a family and pull them, I don't think that those are the three they'd say. Taxes would probably be one of the three, but I think then you would get into the school system, the crime, the, you know,
political culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he says something that leads to that. He says the state's elected officials, quote, will never be responsive except to the people who funded them. And of course, you know, you and I know from our work that the people who fund them are not wealthy bazillionaires. The danger to California is not an industrial class. It's the government unions that raise and spend nearly $1 billion a year, a billion with a B. And he's right. You know, you get these knuckleheads in Sacramento and local officials who are backed, for instance, by the teachers union or organized labor government unions, and they are beholden to those people. The left used to understand as a problem money and politics. Now they still use the language even as they benefit from money and politics. Ultimately, he says the people of California have to get fed up and demand change. There's got to be an above 0% chance of Republicans winning in California. Yeah, I think, you know, you've said this before. We just need a new electorate. That's what we really need. We need an electorate that is awake to these problems, really understands their source. And this is our struggle. You and I shared a very fun story. Eric Garcetti's parents have now registered to lobby for their son's ambassador bid. Of course, Eric Garcetti, mayor of L.A., has been nominated by the Biden administration, gosh, over a year ago now, I think, to go to India. and he's still not there, can't get through. I'll explain why, but you're already smiling and laughing.
I've been so excited for this story. Okay, so Gil Garcetti is still alive.
Yes, his dad, yeah.
Gil Garcetti is now registering as a lobbyist to get his son, who is the failed DA of LA, excuse me, the mayor, failed mayor of Los Angeles, the highly prestigious job of being the ambassador to India, which I am fairly confident that there is no amount of commas or zeros that could get me to take that job.
Really?
Oh, God. You could, I mean, for all these ambassadorships are nonsense jobs. But, like, particularly, like, you go to India a couple times a year. Like, it just, if you got to be an ambassador and go sit and do state dinners and talk to people, like, everything I hate doing more than anything in the world. Talking to people I don't want to talk to, being at dinner events I don't want to be at, in a country that doesn't believe in eating beef.
This is your nightmare.
No, this is like as bad as it gets. And then you're somehow having a hard time getting my nightmare job, not the dream job. You're having a hard time getting the worst job in the world. And you're going to have your dad register as a lobbyist to get you this job. And I'm wondering if his dad has any pull, couldn't he have convicted the most obvious murderer in human history?
You might think. Yeah.
So I would think maybe his dad, like...
You were referring, of course, just for those
like,
who...
Hire Bob Shapiro and Johnny Cochran as your lobbyists, not right. Marsha Clark and Gil Garcetti. This is the weirdest thing I have ever heard.
It is odd.
And did they not know we were going to find out that registering as a lobbyist was not going to be in Politico? Like, you're not embarrassed that your daddy is registering as a lobbyist to get you the job of ambassador to India?
It is fascinating, and I don't know. I mean, I guess this is just his exit, his off ramp, right? I mean, I don't know exactly what's going on. So in May of last year, a year ago, he's nominated for this job. In the meantime, other people who've been nominated for ambassadorships, including Rahm Emanuel, who had his own problems in Chicago. Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah, has he got the Japan gig
yet? He did, yeah.
But that was a little work. And that's because some of the Democrats are mad at him for taking on unions in Chicago.
That's exactly right. And what they tried...
But I would have voted for Emanuel for ambassador to
absolutely.
Japan.
And what the unions did in that case, of course, was to leverage a controversy over the shooting of a... you might remember this, an unarmed teenager who was walking away, I think was shot by Chicago police. And there's some evidence that... The police department, and maybe with some help from the city, covered up that shooting for months before the video was released, and then people went crazy. Of course, it's terrible to see. But so Emanuel gets in, and yet here we are in July of 2020. So before he's nominated, Garcetti is still just Mayor Garcetti. And an LAPD officer who's in the security detail at City Hall alleges that Garcetti's advisor, a guy named Rick Jacobs, made crude remarks and inappropriate touching and that Garcetti laughed. It's one of those, I don't know, it just seems like an odd kind of fight. But this is referred to obliquely in the more liberal press typically as a sex harassment or sex assault case even. And it involves two guys. And I'm not saying that's okay if it's truly sexual harassment, but a cop who figures his best defense is to sue the city for inappropriate touching and crude remarks. I don't know. Just sort of made me think that the LAPD, despite its black uniform, is not so tough. Yeah. So, and in this article that I'll put here in the show notes from Politico, it's fascinating because what all they mention is that Rick Jacobs had sexually assaulted women on the staff. But of course, it's not just women. It's this other guy who's also filed suit. So some weird stuff. Garcetti apparently knew about it. And this is the ostensible reason for keeping him out of the job. So anyhow, that's just an update there. Garcetti will soon have a note from his dad saying he can go to India. And then Twitter.
Am I wrong to harp on this thing about Garcetti not convicting OJ or the Menendez brothers? Like, does no one else think that that is?
So his dad fails to convict OJ, fails to convict the Menendez brothers, right? And that's what you're referring to.
That's a fact.
Yeah. I agree. And he just failed to do it, and yet his...
And now, if I remember correctly, the dad was not the DA at the time of the Rodney King verdict, but came in right after?
I think that's right, yeah.
Okay.
My timing may be off, yeah. But I think you're right. He's the DA at that point, right? And he blows the case.
Just it strikes me as a whole lot of institutional incompetence that was always associated to the Garcetti clan. I know these things go, you know, you get families in politics a lot, and I was never big on the kind of dynastic criticisms of Bush. You may have been. They're fair. They're fair, but I always thought, like, Jeb's either a good candidate or he's not.
That's
George
right.
is either a good candidate or he's not. On the merits, I'm always curious, like, what one's qualifications are. And I, as best I could tell, Hillary's qualifications were always that she was married to Bill. And so that didn't strike me as like this radical claim for feminism. It struck me as what I understood anti-feminism to be. And yet, you know, on the merit, like Bush had his stuff and some was good, some was bad, like whatever. In the Garcetti case, this Eric guy always just seemed kind of incompetent.
Yes.
And so then people could say, like, yeah, you can't blame the kid for the sins of the parents. And I would say, like, okay, well, I think the dad was incompetent, and then I think the son's incompetent.
It's kind of genetic.
And if it isn't genetic, then that's, I guess, just worse.
Yeah.
If anything, I'm offering these people a cop-out with a genetic.
It's how I was raised.
Yeah.
Well, you and I joked, you know, when the nomination was first swirling around over a year ago, you and I joked that you're sending a guy who has overseen the metastasization of homelessness in L.A., and you're sending that guy to India, a problem where endemic poverty is still around. I mean, it's, you know, things are getting better. The market is starting to open up life and liberty there. But this is not a man you send for anything other than those aforementioned dinners. I'm just doing some quick hits here, so we don't need to spend a lot of time on these because there's a couple of other very interesting stories. But Twitter announced that they have hired a guy who has created. I'm sorry, they haven't hired him. He's been there for a while, but he has created Twitter's crisis misinformation policy. And this is the idea Twitter has that this is how they're going to respond to tweets that cause tweets that convey misinformation and cause, you know, sort of, or undermine democracy. Great story. Gosh darn it, where did I find this? I think it's in the Free Beacon, maybe. I didn't write this down, so sorry. Chuck Ross, author, sorry, man, but I'll put it in the show notes. You can find it. Meet the conspiracy theorist behind Twitter's crisis misinformation policy. The guy is Yoel Roth, the head of Twitter's safety and integrity unit. And the policy that Roth outlines will place warning labels on tweets deemed to contain misinformation and prevent them from being amplified or recommended in times of armed conflict, natural disasters, public health emergencies. The writer, Chuck Ross, goes on to say, it's a questionable pick to launch the policy given this guy's own track record with misinformation. Roth oversaw Twitter's decision to block the sharing of an October 2020 New York Post report on emails from Hunter Biden's abandoned laptop. Roth told the FEC, Federal Election Commission, he made the decision based, quote, on rumors shared by the U.S. government's intelligence community that the Russian government might release materials hacked from Hunter Biden. There was and has been no credible evidence that Biden's laptop was hacked or that Russia played a role in publishing emails from it. Jack Dorsey, former Twitter CEO, later admitted blocking the article was a total mistake. This is the same guy who in 2020 referred to Trump officials as actual Nazis. Take that, Vladimir Putin. He also called Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell a bag of farts. Can I say that on this show? Anywho, Twitter continues. And Elon Musk is doing something. I don't know if you've been following this, David, doing something to kind of rejigger his offer to buy Twitter. Have you followed that one?
Well, there's just a newer deal today, I think. And again, I've been kind of in a zone all day, so I didn't get a chance to unpack it. But from what I saw, just on a kind of headline basis, he's increasing his equity component. And then that would decrease the amount of debt taken necessary to leverage the buyout.
Got it. That's roughly what I understood. And I understand about 50% of what you just said. I think there is good news abroad, and I mean like out there in the world, here in the United States of America, about a kind of a corporate, finally, what would you call it, a return to normalcy. We've seen a number of companies accused by the lefties of not following Disney's model of stepping into a bear trap and then blaming the bear trap. Netflix cancels Ibram X. Kendi's animated movie Anti-Racist Baby. Listeners to the show will remember, I think we spoke last week before, about a great memo that went around to Netflix employees and told them, like, basically, look, we're in the job of providing content for people, not monitoring their viewing. And if you don't like that, you got to go find a job someplace else. So here's the new news a couple of days ago. Netflix cancels Ibram X. Kendi, of course. I think almost everybody knows who he is. But this is the guy who's really, you know, sort of part of the whole anti-racism movement and wrote a book called Anti-Racist Baby, and then proposed to Netflix an animated series about this anti-racist baby. It sounds like it could be really funny if it weren't so leaden in its politics. It almost sounds like something that's good for you rather than something you might enjoy. And good for Netflix for getting into it. Like, and apparently it's not because they, you know, hate Ibram X. Kendi or don't think the project is a reasonable one for him to do. They just made the decision that they don't have space in their budget to produce this thing because probably nobody will watch it and laugh or enjoy it. So imagine that, going back to a new metric in which entertainment ought to be entertaining, first and foremost.
Fascinating idea.
Switching back to our friends at Disney, there's an NBC poll a couple of weeks ago. That poll found that Disney's approval is falling with the American public, that the American public now regard Disney in a way that is far more grim than it has been. I mean, like, people have always looked at Disney as one of the most trustworthy organizations in the world. Mm-hmm. And suddenly they've gone to war on a bunch of issues, especially, of course, in Florida. And this poll shows that if you put Disney head-to-head with Ron DeSantis, Disney only narrowly edges out Ron DeSantis. Disney promoters spun this as a huge victory for them. Look, we took on Ron DeSantis and we won. No, this writer here on a blog called That Park Place points out that Disney shouldn't have to compare its meager success against a politician. It is not supposed to be divisive. It's not supposed to be electrifying. It's not supposed to be a leader in public policy. It's supposed to be entertaining kids and families. And the fact that it's only now marginally more, one percentage point ahead on the polling of Ron DeSantis, a politician.
And he's a Nazi, right? Is that
got to be a Nazi.
But what, or because they said literally real Nazis, but that was the Trump people? In the last segment.
In the last story. That was in...
I can't ever keep track anymore.
I'm sorry,
of
man.
Who's real Nazis and who are... What is it? I guess the opposite of a real Nazi is a fake Nazi.
A fake Nazi.
And does that mean someone who wants to be a Nazi but doesn't have the guts to do it?
It's a fake
Or
Nazi.
Does that mean they have it's like a costume? It's a Nazi costume.
Like the royal family.
I think that... that if you're a great politician, in theory, a very popular politician, and to non-partisanize this, I will say use both Ronald Reagan, who I adore, and Barack Obama, who was popular with the Democrats, mm-hmm. that I would expect both Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama to be less popular than Disney.
Yes.
Because I would presume in the pop culture of our lives that there are sort of family entertainment that so transcends politics that you just cannot get 100% of people to like Barack Obama because of the partisanship of it. Yeah. And you can't get 100% to like Reagan, but you should be able to get this really high percentage to like, you know, Cinderella.
Yes.
And
Mickey Mouse.
I was going to say Batman. you know, like the childhood ones are the easy part, but then now, especially when you add in the Lucasfilm franchise, and you look at even like Marvel, the Pixar, everybody likes all this stuff, right?
Right, everybody.
And yet this is the most avoidable corporate PR joke in history. There was absolutely no reason for them to fall into it. And then here's the real problem. People go, yeah, so you're saying their publicist screwed up or the CEO took the bait and that was the mistake. No. That's what I would like that to be a mistake, and I like people to get fired, and I like to move on. The problem is that they really do have people, and I don't suggest it's every single person in the C-suite, but they clearly really do have people that explicitly do want to groom young people
yes.
into this all these things that are clearly uncomfortable to the majority of Americans.
Yeah. Yeah.
That indoctrination is not like they messed up the messaging.
Right.
I just don't understand what the hell's going on. I really don't.
Well, it is, to me, I'm not a business observer the way you are, but this just strikes me as one of the most boneheaded moves I've seen a chief executive officer do, and that is direct your company right into the crosshairs of a, you know, or get stuck in a crossfire of a highly divisive and contentious issue. Your product is family and family values of a sort. And I'm not saying which kind of family values, but shoot, Disney did all kinds of stuff that is, you know, most people find really agreeable, and suddenly their ratings are way down. How long before a board steps in a situation like that, David, and just says, like, look, man, you know, our popularity is declining and you did this, you're gone?
Yeah, it depends. Boards are not what they used to be, you know. There's very few boards that are actually speaking truth to power anymore. I would have to look at the composition of Disney's board, which I used to be more intimately familiar with. I suspect they're a bunch of liberal hacks, too. I would be real surprised if they have any board members that are taking seriously their fiduciary duty to protect shareholder capital.
There's a big story in the LA Times that I really enjoyed. A listener sent this, and I am, again, sorry that I'm not mentioning the person's name because I didn't ask for permission. So great story selection. I can't imagine anybody would be upset at this guy for sending me the story in the LA Times headlined, "Welcome to Portugal, the new expat heaven. Californians, please go home," by Javed Kalim. And he reports from Portugal. Fascinating kind of long-form journalism piece that I'll, of course, as always, put in the show notes for us. But David, the interesting thing to me is that this is part of the problem. I was talking to a donor who used to live in California, has moved to Texas. And he told me that, you know, he's really now focused, you know, he's kind of turned his back in California. He's focused on just, you know, staying in Texas and doing his business now. And my point to him was, and of course you could, you know, full disclosure, I'm hitting this guy up for contributions to California Policy Center. But my point is, you can't escape California through myriad sorts of ways, political power, the power of our unions to play with millions of dollars in outside of California kinds of races to try to direct national policy through our massive congressional delegation. Californians themselves carry a portfolio, a menu of expectations into a place like Portugal, which really does sound very much like California, really delightful, less expensive, poverty problems, government bureaucracy that makes California look effective and efficient and Germanic. But the stories these Californians tell is they go there, they want these things. And the writer does a wonderful job of describing one of these ladies, you know, wearing her yoga pants and her cross trainers and expecting that Portugal's going to be just like California. And the locals are starting to push back against not their public policy positions or their politics, but the cultural change that these Californians bring simply with their dollars. And so in Texas, in Florida, in Tennessee, my concern for those places is that not all Californians who leave there leave consciously, leave their politics behind, if you will. Not politics formally, but cultural politics, if you will. Their cultural characteristics.
Oh, their value system.
Yeah.
There's a lot that goes into that.
So, you know, I got asked the other day,
why am I not seeing this in your notes?
I don't know. Here, try this one.
The shorter version, did you not do the link?
I thought I did. I've got it right here. It's in the middle of National.
Oh, yeah.
See
okay.
That? There you go.
I don't know how I wouldn't find a link out of the 26 links that you put right in the middle there.
And this
you
is the short one.
This is the shorter one. Yeah, that sorry, I love buddy. That. The title was Shorter Fast Radio Free California,
yeah.
Which it is shorter, so you were correct. But I have the link up.
Okay. So my question is, I was asked the other day, I was being interviewed on a podcast with a guy you know, Matt Lewis in the News. He interviewed you about There's No Free Lunch, extolled the virtues of the book, and loved your interview with him. And he asked me, you know, given all the—
Matt writes a Daily Beast, by the way, and I just want to commend him. He's a friend. He's one of the good guys.
Isn't it amazing? He's at the Daily Beast. Yeah. I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
Really good guy. And I honestly don't know his politics. He didn't like tip his hand, but the
fact
that he interviewed
you, I met him
at
Club for Growth many years ago. He you know, look, he was no Trump guy. He was pretty outspokenly critical of Trump, which I would argue was probably a reflection of his integrity. He also, though, was it has always been just kind of a guy who is a real movement conservative. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Smart guy.
Well, among these people who left for Portugal and people who leave for other states or other countries, they go to these other places, they bring their politics with them, center, left, right, whatever. But the question that Matt Lewis put to me was, why do you stay? And that's a complicated answer.
You know? Well, here's the thing. He was asking you why you stay in California when it's a mess. Yeah. I would also think it's appropriate to say, if someone goes, I'm leaving California for the politics, and then goes, I'm going to Lisbon, you could also maybe ask, have you spent any time evaluating the politics of the European Union,
yeah,
or particularly Portugal?
Which Portugal's fascist past.
I'm sure. Well, I don't care about the past. I mean, I do, but that's not even my point. It's not exactly like, they're not really studying Friedrich Hayek over there in Lisbon these days.
No.
So at the end of the day, the answer usually when one goes from one liberal place to another liberal place is it was lifestyle driven. It was economic. It was what Elon Musk said. It's lower taxes, regulation.
Right.
But when he asked you why you stay, I think you and I have disagreed on this in the past. I have three things to say. Number one is I believe that people have a right to go if they want to go. I think I always have struggled with the fact that on one hand, they certainly have a right to just say it's best for me and my family to go. Mm-hmm, I do not believe all people are commanded to stay and fight. Mm-hmm. However, how do I say this? I am not sure that everyone who stays and fights will end up staying. Like there, in other words, sometimes people staying, it's a not yet,
mm-hmm,
because there's a breaking point that a lot of people have. You know, it's unfortunately that exists in marriages, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And those are covenantal institutions. I don't think one's state residency is covenantal membership. I'm sorry. So the issue as to why one stays about, you know, staying to fight. In some cases, there's specific circumstances. Like, yeah, I would go, but my kids are in school. Mm-hmm. My job is here. I'm friends. I have too many friends in our church to leave at this point. Or like in your case, I'm just too old to go anywhere else. I don't. What the hell do you want me to do? By the time I get the U-Haul, you know, they're going to be collecting the long-term care check. But then I also finally, this is my closing point on the three. I guess there is a part of me that has always struggled with maybe people should go if we're ever going to get action to like make change, because we're sort of like enabling them to continue this insanity. It's not an argument I find super compelling, but I wrestle with it because I do kind of think a lot of people should go. Your argument's always been a lot of people should stay and fight. Let's make change. And I think I feel that way about the country more so than I feel about the state. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like if someone said, as people tell us five times a day, I left California to go to Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
I just go, yeah, okay. If someone said to me, I didn't even know about this thing in Portugal. I didn't even know. I would be like, what, you're leaving the country? Mm-hmm, really?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It doesn't do much for me. So I feel a more emotional, patriotic, and I think temperamentally, like I'll fight for the country. Well, California, there is a part of me that sometimes it says, I love the state. I don't want them to do what they're doing. And there's sometimes there's a part of me that says, screw you guys. What you deserve to not have people like me and Will in your state anymore.
Mm. Yeah, I get that. And I like you, I would never suggest there's some sort of moral imperative to stay. It feels that way to me, I think, in part because there's a kind of a romantic connection to the place, you know, a family that goes back several a couple of centuries in my dad's case. And I also feel like in defending California and fighting to reform it, we are defending America. California is a big, influential state. It is, you know, it goes, there's the old, it's not hyperbole, but it's become kind of a cliche, but it's true. And that is that California is like the world's fifth largest economy. It is a big, vibrant, dynamic place, and what we do affects the rest of the country, and the country really is, you know, nothing shows it like Ukraine right now. We are the arsenal of democracy, and not just in terms of weapons, but ideas. And if we allow California to run off the rails rather than fight to reform it, then we are really undermining American security. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that, you know, our role in the supply chain crisis, for instance, with regard to our mismanagement of the Port of Los Angeles and Long Beach, which we've talked about on this show. That's a problem. Wildfire smoke drifts all over the country. That's a problem. Banning bacon, which was the subject of one of our conversations, in which California's weird dietary predilections have now become so huge that they've changed the market nationally. Raising prices for everybody. Our green policies with regard to vehicles have reshaped the trajectories of car companies.
Now, the straw thing going on here is national, or is that just here?
Where in the hell was I recently? New Orleans, and they do not have a straw ban. And
there's not a straw ban in California. If you want a cardboard straw that literally
collapses,
disintegrates into your mouth, and just leaves you the great, delicious taste
of paper.
Now, I don't really believe actually in drinking a drink through a straw anyways, just since I'm not a 7-year-old boy anymore. But here's
use a sippy cup like all grown men.
By the way, how's your breakfast going? You still got the cereal?
I do. Yeah.
Good.
It's actually a late night preference, like Jerry Seinfeld, apparently. I did not know this.
Oh, does he eat cereal late at night?
Very much.
Where were we? On the straws.
Straws.
Yeah. There are things in the list of insanities that are going to help the cause.
Right.
They will help hasten the moment, much like some of the craziness of cancel culture. The pendulum is swung.
Mm-hmm.
Netflix is moving in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 2 months, Disney has taken out some of their craziness. You had State Farm, I think, was going to be putting a whole transgenderist thing in their, their kind of HR manuals. Mm-hmm. They took it out.
Mm-hmm.
There are things moving the other way because it went too far. With California, some of the stuff about straws and plastic bags and this and that, they end up pushing things the other direction. But the stuff that, is the end of the line is when you start talking about banning bacon. I'm sorry. It's not going to happen.
Not for you. That would cause you to leave.
I will be in one of those witness protection neighborhoods from, did you ever see that movie, My Blue Heaven?
Uh-huh, I did.
With Steve Martin. He had this New York mobster who is in witness protection and all of a sudden he's used to the great Italian restaurants and New York night dining, and he's in just a strip mall kind of thing in a suburban neighborhood, and it was awful. And I would go to one of those neighborhoods before I would live in a state that banned bacon. It's a pork fat thing.
Is this really what the investment in New York is all about?
Well, the food is a huge part of it, but I've never denied that.
Yeah.
I've always stated that the pickup in food quality is so much better. I love to, red state people be like, why do you like New York so much? Because the food's delicious. They're all, we got great food here. And I'm like,
Waffle House.
And then
no,
they come to New York and they're all like, okay, I wouldn't say this on Twitter, but the food in New York's really good.
Now, when I work for the Village Voice guys, who are out of New York, of course, I worked for them for 12 years, they would come out to visit. I would go out there to visit. And you could get similar meals in L.A. and New York. And the New Yorkers were shocked. When we would go to San Francisco occasionally and meet up there.
Yeah.
And the food's amazing. And the price is like a third or a half.
I don't think that's true anymore.
Not anymore. Okay.
I don't think that's true anymore.
All right. Well, I haven't been to New York in too long. So, hey, let's turn to another local matter. And again, I just want to say that though this is an Orange County.
Oh, also keep in mind, too.
Yeah.
The great chefs that you can find now, like in Naples, Florida, or in L.A., they probably started in New York.
Hmm.
So you know what I mean? There's the, what do they call it? The Bill Parcells factor. There's a coaching tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always good. But ultimately, just in terms, it's not just fine dining. It's like you brought Waffle House. I'm saying, what if you just want a diner, a snack?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's of another level.
And New York.
Pizza, bagels, that caliber of food, all the way up to kind of finer dining options, steakhouse, Italian, French, whatever. Chinese food, the whole deal. Look, can we wrap up? I'm starving.
I can't make it fast. Is that okay? How's your time? Okay, so let's talk about Anaheim real quickly. We talked about this last week. FBI has... basically revealed that it wired up an informant and found that numerous city officials, or I should say officials in the city and of the city's government, were involved in what they allege was a kind of pay-to-play thing. And the mayor, Harry Sidhu, a Republican, was caught specifically saying that he had done something so good for the Major League Baseball's team, the Major League Baseball's Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, that they basically should contribute about $1 million to his reelection campaign. And this was apparently caught on tape and is being used to charge him. Sidhu resigned. It got more interesting because, this is it looks like Republican on Republican violence here, because there were a lot of conservatives like you and I who felt that Harry was too connected to some folks there. And you predicted this years ago, that this was going to be a problem in Anaheim, not necessarily with Harry, but specifically with Anaheim. And it involves Disney going back years.
I did predict that it would end poorly for Harry. I did predict he was corrupt. I did predict specifics with him. The only thing I would say is I believe that based on the even superlative corruption of some of his predecessors.
Yes.
And supporters.
Yeah. And we also had it on good authority from a previous mayor, Tom Tate, who was a really good guy. And you and I watched how he got spun out by the machine up there. But the machine, like all good political machines in a big city, operated left and right. It really was a bipartisan thing. Now it turns out that a high-ranking state Democratic Party official was involved, or is at least resigned from the party because she's being implicated. And of course, government unions were very steeply involved in this whole deal. With we had cops and firefighter unions specifically running interference for these corrupt candidates. And I'm not saying that either of these unions or the Democratic official were necessarily, they haven't been charged with anything. I mean, I think they were just out there sort of following direction, supporting candidates who supported them. But this is the disgusting sort of, confidence game being played by a lot of crony capitalists. And it's just so fascinating to watch some of our, if not real friends, acquaintances on the conservative side, again, get twisted around the axle of being pro-business rather than pro-markets. That was the big update this week in Anaheim. And the feds are, really drawing the noose pretty tightly around a bunch of these guys. And so I just ask others to watch for this in your neighborhood. Like, if you see people giving away things in order to attract business and they call it economic development, be aware. Be very aware. Watch the campaign contributions, the independent expenditures. I'm going to jump to one of my favorite moments of the last couple of weeks. Last week, a power outage delayed the start of the California legislature. I offer you this as not just fact, but metaphor. Here's the headline from the Associated Press. A power outage in California's capital left much of the downtown area in the dark and delayed the start of the state legislature. That was on May 19th. What was fascinating was that, of course, we've got a massive plan to electrify everything and get rid of all carbon emissions in California, which will plunge us into darkness, because a new study comes out from a Stanford University professor. I read this in Yahoo Finance. California's electrical grid has an EV problem. Here's the bottom line. If everybody starts buying EVs at the rate the state of California wants you to buy them and starts plugging those things in, we're going to crash the grid. Mm. We are absolutely not capable right now of running Newsom's dream team. Last story, David, if I may. Gavin Newsom says that we've got a massive surplus, of course. We talk about this all the time. I won't bore listeners with a whole bunch of detail here, except to say that almost every time Newsom mentions the budget surplus, it's important to footnote that. I am hearing this all over the left. Look at how great Newsom is. He's running a surplus in this big state. Isn't he a genius? Until you start to poke through the assets and receivables and et cetera. The assets and liabilities. As John Morlock, former state senator, did for California Policy Center, his article I'll post in the show notes is called "A Surplus of Nonsense in the Governor's Latest Budget." He says the state's debt of $208 billion on its most recent balance sheet is owing primarily to unfunded expenses for public employees. And he says that's going to cost us $11 billion per year just in interest payments. But of course, that principal is rising. So those interest payments will go up. We do not have a surplus. We are deeply, deeply in debt. I could talk about other stories here, David, like Dave Chappelle and the developments in that story with his attacker and his assailant and George Gascon. But
they're not charging him, right?
They did not charge the guy who attacked Dave. George Gascon, the DA who's facing a recall, did not see the attack on Dave Chappelle as worthy of a felony assault. Said, well, you know, yes, he was carrying a replica gun, but it was just a replica. And he didn't mean to kill or severely injure Dave Chappelle when he stormed the stage at Hollywood Bowl. That got Gascon in some hot water. Chappelle's team came out and said, this is ludicrous. So Gascon's still in deep trouble. Polling shows that his recall is increasingly likely and that the group running the recall is likely, in fact, to qualify those signatures for his recall. But we will approach that another time when we have more time. David, anything else you want to add before we sign off?
No, sorry, it's a little shorter one today. We got a late start because of my meeting running late. Now I got to run to another meeting, but it's just nice to be with you. And I sure appreciate all of our listeners as well.
Me too, buddy. Thank you. That's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That boosts our profile and helps others find us. You can email us with your comments and story suggestions. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. Also, follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host Dave Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, our engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, and all of our friends at National Review. Thanks also to Metalachi. That's the LA-based mariachi and metal band. They supply that awesome kick-butt music for us. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima. ¶¶